I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Daniel Lubetsky, founder of Kind Healthy Snacks, a food company that produces sweet and savory bars with whole nuts, spices, and fruit, among other products. Kind is sold in a diversity of locations, including Whole Foods, Costco, Amtrak trains, and newspaper stands. Daniel is also the founder of Peaceworks, a producer of Mediterranean spreads such as tapenades, hummus, and baba ganoush. Peaceworks aims to foster business relationships among neighbors in the Middle East and other groups in conflict as a way to reduce conflict in those regions. Daniel grew up in Mexico City and speaks Spanish, English, Hebrew, and French, and a little bit of Yiddish, no?
Yeah.
Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Jessica.
Before we dig into Kind, I want to talk about Peaceworks, which was the company you founded in 1993 that focuses on Mediterranean spreads. What was the germ for founding this food company in the early 90s?
I didn't know it was going to be a food company. It was more about trying to use business as a force for bringing Arabs and Israelis together. That was what I was very passionate about since writing my college thesis and law school work about how to use market forces to help trading partners shatter cultural stereotypes, cement relations with each other. So that was the impetus of what I was doing. And it became a food company because as I was looking for ventures, I was looking in apparel, I was looking in Dead Sea minerals, and food became the area where I found my passions best. I didn't understand Dead Sea minerals too well, but I understood food, and that's how it started.
And so food was secondary to the primary mission was to facilitate joint ventures among conflicting neighbors. So what's an example of a collaboration which you established at Peaceworks between two conflicting groups?
Well, the flagship venture, which still exists today, which is how we started, was my discovery of a sun-dried tomato spread. And when I, long story short, found out the company had gone bankrupt because it was sourcing its glass jars from Portugal and its sun-dried tomatoes from Italy, and it was very expensive. And when I came to Yoel Benesh, the Israeli manufacturer, and told him about my ideas, he had Arab friends and he really believed in the philosophy of what we're trying to do with Peaceworks. But I also showed him that he could benefit economically, that he could buy the glass jars from Egypt instead of Portugal, the sun-dried tomatoes from Turkish suppliers instead of Italian ones. So they started buying basil and olives and olive oil from Palestinian citizens of the West Bank and Gaza. And that's how it started.
How did you secure distribution in the United States with Peaceworks? Can you walk through that process? Because in a way, you piggybacked on that with Kind.
Well, I didn't know what I was doing, so I emptied my legal briefcase. Literally, I had this big briefcase for carrying legal documents, and I filled it up with jars of sun-dried tomato spreads, basil pestos, olive spreads. And I would start at the top of Broadway on 122nd Street on the west side and then just start walking store by store till I would go at 7 a.m. in the morning till I would end at 7 p.m. at night in the bottom of Wall Street. And then I would cross the next day and I would go up Broadway on the other side of Broadway. And Broadway was an important choice because it was the avenue that I found to have the most concentration of grocery stores. So I knew Second Avenue, I knew Third Avenue, I knew Madison. I did all of them. But Broadway was the juiciest. And I would not go to the next store unless I got either an order or an explanation for what I needed to do different in order to get an order the next time. And I drove many people nuts because everything was wrong, but they were basically taught me, like Scott Goldschein and Mr. Zabar from Zabar's basically taught me what the consumers were looking for. So I really learned a lot of what I do today from all the store managers and buyers at the grocery shops and bodegas in New York City.
What is an example of something that Mr. Zabar, you know, taught you?
Everything. I mean, I came in and they didn't have much patience because they had thousands of consumers going around and here I am and I don't know what I'm doing. But they really liked that they really cared about my mission. And I think they just had patience with me. So they taught me what is the margin requirements for a retailer, for a distributor, and for yourself so that you can run an ongoing business. They taught me about the labels, how to make sure that the name is clearer. The jars back then were oozing olive oil out of them, and that was not acceptable. So it was a lot of sessions.
You mentioned that you had a law degree. You went to Stanford Law School and you became a lawyer. And the idea for PeaceWorks came out of a paper, your thesis that you wrote, which I believe was entitled Incentives for Peace and Profits, Federal Legislation to Encourage U.S. Enterprises to Invest in Arab-Israeli Joint Ventures.
Yeah, it became a very famous document among doctors. Because if you were having insomnia and were having trouble falling asleep, they would give it to you. You would read it and you would fall asleep immediately. Because it was the most theoretical, boring thing in the world. It was totally devoid of practical use, but it was beautiful theoretically.
You dabbled in the law before starting businesses. You had a stint at Sullivan and Cromwell. You clerked for Supreme Justice in Texas. Did you think that you might want a career in law?
I loved the law. It was not that I was trying to escape the law. I just had this, you call it a germ. I had this bug inside me that I just really felt that my mission in life was to try to build bridges and to end the Arab-Israeli conflict. And suddenly here's the Oslo peace process. So all my ideas that I've been sharing for several years, suddenly they go from being delusional to being slightly tenable. And I'm like, all right, I have to try to pursue it and I have to try it.
You also had a kind of a social ethos in your family. Your father was a prominent figure in your upbringing and the way you think about the world. He was a Holocaust survivor, having survived Dachau, the concentration camp in Germany. Can you talk a little bit about him?
Yeah, my dad was my greatest hero and role model. He was the most humble person. He built himself from scratch. He came to Mexico after the war. He was 15 and a half years old when the war started, 16 when he got to Mexico. He didn't speak Spanish or English.
He's from Lithuania originally.
Yeah, he was born in Riga, Latvia, and raised in Lithuania when he was 9 years old, 1939. The war started, and I'll tell you the story. It's a little strong, but he was coming back with his father to the apartment house where they lived, and the superintendent showed them into where the garage was, and he opened the door of the garage, and there was a pile of bodies, and he told my grandfather, "You see all these people? They're all the Jews in the building, and you're lucky that you always were nice to me and treated with me respect and kindness, so I spared you and your family, but get out before I change my mind." So that night, my father, who's 9 years old, and his brother and my grandfather and grandmother packed whatever they could carry, and then they left into a ghetto. And that was a story that my dad told me when I was 9 years old. And my mom said, "Roman, what are you doing? This kid is 9 years old, you know. You're going to, what are you doing? Please stop telling him this." And my dad said, "Look, he's 9 years old and he needs to hear it." Mm-hmm. I was 9 years old and I needed to live it. But the other thing that was no less powerful and important was the stories that he told me about people that in the worst of circumstances would rise up and do something kind, like this German soldier that threw a potato to him. And my dad used to tell the story of how he felt he was going to die and he was really malnourished, and that potato meant for him the difference and survival. And the soldier took a risk by giving him food for the soldiers. So those were the stories that I most admired, the way my dad always remembered the moments of kindness. I mean, it's the darkest of moments. And there's a quote that I really love that connects to that, about from Rabbi Hillel, that says, "In a place where there is no humanity, strive thou to be human."
So the name Kind Healthy Snacks, did your father have influence on the naming of the product?
The name Kind was created by my team, and I. It's really fascinating that we finally zoned in on it, because it wasn't, today it's so obvious that that's perfect name for us, but back then we had all these crazy ideas for the name. The reason we came up with Kind is that it had human attributes that we were really trying to aspire to be a part, to define us, you know, to do the kind thing for your body, to do the kind thing for your taste buds and to do the kind thing for your world.
It's striking that your father was very forthcoming with his stories and chose to talk about the wartime versus others who really receded and did not tell their family such stories, just more for self-preservation and family's preservation than anything. What was the impetus for your family's, your father's moving to Mexico, of all places?
Jessica, can I just comment on the thing you just said, because it's really important. I was surrounded by other Holocaust survivors growing up, and I loved them dearly, but you could tell that they were just consumed by the horrible horrors that they had gone through, and they couldn't have a positive outlook. And my dad, or there were others that were able to just shut it out and just have a positive life moving forward. My dad had the strength to recall those horrors, but in a positive way, and still he was such a sweet, kind-hearted man, very gregarious, always making people laugh, always almost like he saw his mission to make people have a better day and make people laugh. Did you see the movie Life is Beautiful? So when I saw that movie, I cried a lot, and then I was a little bit troubled because I felt guilty to be laughing also. And I asked my dad, you know, it never crossed my mind that in such horrible circumstances you could actually say jokes in the middle of a concentration camp. And my dad said, the opposite. The only reason my dad felt that he survived is because my grandfather was a really funny joke teller, and he would entertain the Jewish inmates and the German soldiers with funny stories and make people more humane and more human by making them laugh and just find, particularly in those more dark moments, some levity.
You were brought up in Mexico City. How was being Jewish in a predominantly Christian place?
Well, I also lived in a very insulated cocoon. You pointed out earlier, I learned Yiddish at an early age, and I learned Yiddish before I learned Hebrew or English. And for my mom, it was very important that I build bridges. So she introduced me to this kid named Luis, who we made play dates in our neighborhood for me to be friends with him. And I was in such a cocoon that, you know, we were playing once, and I said, you know, if you do this, I'm going to kick you in the tuches. And he says, what? What is this tuches thing? And I'm like, stop joking. Tuches, tushin, you're back, you're behind, your ass. And he's like, no, that's nalga. I didn't know that tuches was a word in Yiddish. There were many other words that I can't tell you right now because they're stronger, that I thought were Spanish, but were actually Yiddish. Mm-hmm. That's the world that I was raised in. And I think my mom was the one that gave us the impetus to make sure that we always built relationships with people that were different from us.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Daniel Lubetzky, founder of Kind Healthy Snacks. We'll hear more from Daniel coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Daniel Lubetzky, founder of Kind Healthy Snacks, a food company that produces sweet and savory bars with a variety of whole nuts, spices, and fruit, among other products like granola. Daniel launched Kind in 2003, and its products can be found in several diverse locations, ranging from Whole Foods to convenience stores and gas stations. So here you are. You founded Peaceworks. You were running this Mediterranean food spread company. And what was the germ then for Kind bars?
I was traveling all over, and I was very frustrated with my lack of healthy snacking options. It felt that if it was healthful and wholesome, it would not travel well. And what would travel well was either too indulgent or tasted like cardboard or was just totally artificial. I didn't find something that fit with what I was looking for. So my impetus was I was always on the lookout for healthy snacks, and Kind was the recognition that there were not those options.
What did you grab before you concocted the Kind bars? What are some of the things?
I truly, sincerely did not have very good options. I would take sometimes just nuts and fruit, but then the nuts, you overate them because you couldn't do portion control.
Which nuts?
Almonds, primarily, raw almonds. Yeah, of course, I also ate muffins, and I also still today eat, you know, some indulgent snacks here and there. I'm not perfect, but more and more, I think every day for me, it's a journey to try to improve my lifestyle. I eat two kind bars every single day, no less than two. Today I've had three so far.
How many varieties, as of now, are there of kind bars?
I think we have like 25 flavors of kind bars.
Do you worry at all about the burden of choice? I enjoy your bars, but I'm a little overwhelmed when I'm like, oh, I don't know, just give me four choices.
I agree. It's a very, very tough challenge. Did you read the book Paradox of Choice?
No, but I understand the phenomenon. That's how I feel.
Sometimes you feel paralyzed by those choices. So I think we do need to, we look at this constantly, and it is a balance, because when we discontinue products, the first person to pick up the phone is my brother. It's like, why do you always discontinue the ones that are my favorites? Because you always find someone that was the biggest fan of that walnut date or the sesame chocolate, and they were among our lowest turning items, but they had a core following of fans. And so that's the tricky. And each of them is like your children. You love them all, so you don't want to like give the death to anyone. But you have to. You have to be disciplined.
So returning to the early days of Kind, here you are like Willy Loman selling your your piece works. That's from Death of a Salesman, by the way.
I know.
Selling your piece works.
I know Willy Loman too well. I can tell you my Willy Loman moment.
Please.
I'm in Waldbaum's, which is a grocery chain at their headquarters, and I look around. It's all vinyl furniture from the 1960s. Everybody surrounding me is like 50 years older than me, and they all have sampling suitcases like mine. And I'm like, wow, what am I doing with my life? And this was a very tough moment right before the launch of Kind. Little did I know that after 10 years of killing myself, success was just around the corner. Oh my God, we've been trying so hard and it just hasn't worked out. And
with this Mediterranean spread company.
Yeah, with the Meditale spreads, they were great products, but there was a very small niche and there was 1,000 things that I had done wrong. And I'm just like, wow, you know, I threw away my law career. My dad is worried. My mom is worried. And am I ever going to get married? Am I going to have children? But I really, you know, we were having such difficult time making ends meet, just being able to make payroll. And just I had to take a $24,000 salary for many years. And many months I could not even pay myself my monthly portion. And then, you know, a couple years later, suddenly Kind, we finally hit it with Kind, and then it just explodes. It just shows you that when you believe in something, you should be careful not to give up, because it can be just around the corner.
In that dark place, little did you know that the success of Kind was almost in your grasp. You continued to go door-to-door, still after over a decade of this Pieceworks company. You were fortunate, though, because you had this distribution network in place, albeit small, that the Mediterranean spreads was the Trojan horse for your Kind bars.
We were fortunate, above all, that people liked us. That people thought, these guys deserve a break. And I think there was a lot of goodwill in there. If you had asked me the year when we launched Kind, whether I knew that it was going to succeed and be explosive, of course I believed in it, otherwise I wouldn't be doing it. But I, to be sincere, and I consider myself a person that has a good vision and can dream, I could have never imagined that Kind would become what it became.
One of the innovations of Kind was that they were, you know, actual nuts and fruit, and that they weren't pasty. Why are so many bars historically that are sold in retail kind of that, you know, that pasty consistency?
Well, it's easier to run a product through the line if it's a paste or an emulsion. It's called a slab bar in our space because it goes slabs of product that fall in the sheeter, and they are all homogeneous and they all run through the line very efficiently. So it's a very efficient way to run a lot of product very fast. And when we came up with the temerity to try to think of it differently, a lot of times the manufacturers that we approached said, you know, it's not practical for us because your runs are very low and it's so much less efficient to run your product. It was hard to convince not just the manufacturers, but even the retailers. We would go with our products and show them our whole nut and fruit bars, and they'd say, yeah, where do I put your product? I'm like, well, next to all these other nutritional bars. I'm like, no, that's not a nutritional bar. Let me show you what a nutritional bar looks like. And they'd show us the slab bars, and it was very hard to convince them to give us a shot in those sets.
You were selling a product that you would say that you could, whose ingredients you could see and pronounce. And why was the clear package, such an innovation? Why were there opaque packages before? I mean, it seems like common sense, but you know, what's the big deal?
The most obvious things may not seem obvious before they're done, right? So when we were doing it, the conventional wisdom was that you had to use opaque film to prevent the product from oxidizing, from losing moisture, and that you needed to use aluminum foil or other opaque materials. We worked really hard in creating clear wrappers with the technology that it could have all those properties through clear film. It's actually deceptively simple, but it was very hard to achieve that.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Daniel Lubetzky, founder of Kind Healthy Snacks, a food company that produces bars with whole nuts and fruit, among other products. I want to talk about nuts for a moment. I'm partial to almonds. There are rankings of nuts that are more nutritional than others and more rare. And teach me something about nuts.
Depends on which industry association you talk to. They each are going to tell you that theirs are better. But certainly, I think the consensus is that almonds, walnuts are among the most helpful or a very helpful category. But everything that's nuts, pecans, pistachios, cashews also have some role. Cashews have more fat than almonds and walnuts. But what's more important to highlight is, did you read about the Harvard study? There was a study that came out by the Harvard School of Medicine that if you eat more nuts, you will live longer. It was like staggering. I actually used to, when I launched Kind and I knew it was a healthful product, I used to be very careful about not eating more than one Kind bar a day because I just felt that I don't want to eat too many fats. And the data indicates that what's powerful about nuts at a minimum is that they're highly satiating and so they displace empty calories. And then on top of that, the nuts have the fats that are helpful healthy to your heart, that help reduce your bad cholesterol levels. So I do think that fundamentally nuts are an important building block.
You mentioned almonds and walnuts. Are they more expensive?
Yeah, on average, I think almonds are increasing in price. We just had a very tough crop where our prices went way up. There's a huge problem right now with bees. Bees are dying, and almost like 70% of all of our human consumption is pollinated by bees. And bees are dying by hordes, and they have to transport them and pollinate different farms. And then the transportation and the mono-pollination may be contributing to this problem of bee collapse. It's a very serious, very scary problem.
Regarding distribution, was there an important relationship or kind of pivot that caused the floodgates to open on the distribution front?
It's all been very gradual. We did it the right way this time because before, when I was starting, I used to try to be everything everywhere as soon as you can. And you really need to be smart about your distribution and migration strategy. You need to first start with the product, the stores where your most solid consumer and fans are going to be. So it's like the Whole Foods, the natural, and the specialty stores. And so that's where we started. And we still today focus enormous efforts and marketing with our core because that's where they have traffic and loyal consumers. And only then we start going into national grocery chains and then convenience stores and specialty and alternative markets. And then only recently, in the last couple of years, did we start going into mass accounts like Walmart and Target and clubs like Costco and Sam's. It was very steady and gradual.
You mentioned before that you paid yourself a $24,000 salary, and initially your marketing budget for the first few years was, you know, like $800 of your sampling budget. But your salary and the sampling budget took a turn in 2008 when you brought on private equity investors in VMG, and they're a fund that invests in consumer products. And Darius Bykoff, the founder of Vitamin Water, or Glasso, made that introduction.
Correct.
How do you know Darius?
So Darius was friends with Andy and Melissa Komaroff, who are my dear friends for many years. And I was entertaining another transaction, and I asked Darius for advice. And I said, do I need to do it this way, this way, this way, which I'm being told? And he said, no, you don't. You can do it whatever way you want. And let me actually introduce you to VMG and we'll co-invest. What I had done right until then was come up with a concept, with a product, with a good culture in the company. What I had not done right is that after 15 years of being in the wilderness, I was so scared to take risks and to invest in letting more people try our product. That's why our sampling budget was $800, because I saw that as an expense to be cut rather than as an investment. And then we suddenly realized, wow, 9 out of 10 people that try a Kind Bar become part of your franchise. And so thanks to my partners, we built a phenomenal field marketing team to let people sample. And so from the first 2009, it was an $800,000 budget instead of $800 before. And then today, it's about $13 million that we go into just giving new Kind Bars to new consumers.
And then in spring 2014, you bought back VMG's stake for $228 million, mostly cash deal, which was basically 13 times their initial investment. Things have come a long way since that Walbaum's moment.
Yes. And the team that we have today, in particular, is every morning I wake up and I feel so blessed and so grateful to be working with people that are better than I will ever be at what they do.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Daniel Lubetzky, founder of Kind Healthy Snacks, a food company that produces bars with whole nuts and spices and fruit, among other products like granolas. I want to go back to your family for a moment. You mentioned before that your father had this positive stance. Do you feel like that was a biological proclivity, that he was just innately that way? You mentioned your grandfather was the same way.
Well, that's a great question. I ask related questions all the time, but not particularly that question. It's a really great question. I don't know. I do think that, you know, I have 4 children, and from the day they're born, you can tell that they have personalities, and it's fascinating and wonderful to see how they really are their own persons, and they're quite different. I have twins, and they are quite different from each other. But I also do think that nurture can guide a person and shape them. I think it's a combination of DNA and genes and the environment. But then again, you know, how did my dad in such an environment manage to be such an extraordinarily sweet, warm, and loving person? Was it because by then, by the age of 9, he had already built it up?
Do you meditate or exercise to enhance?
I take a lot of time to think. We are so barraged with inputs like inbox, email, voicemail, Twitter, messengers, this, that, and you carry your smartphone everywhere you go, and you're just constantly trying to keep up with the data and read more news, and our brains are craving those data points. So I consciously try to find times in the day, sometimes when you run, but it might also just be when you're taking a shower, it might also be right before you go to bed, it might be when you just have half an hour to rest and you're about to grab that phone and you say, you know what, let me just be with myself and let me talk to myself.
Do you talk to yourself out loud?
No. I don't think I talk to myself out loud.
Because in Judaism, the reason you pray out loud is not so that God could hear you only. It's so that you could also hear yourself.
That's beautiful. I'll start paying attention to that. But I think it's more just
silent.
Focusing, yeah.
You are a magician.
A magician, yeah.
Magicians are entertainers. Making magic requires practice and repetition. In what way has magic influenced your business?
I think magic is definitely a big part of my personality and who I am, both because it requires you to be innovative and creative, and because of what you brought forth about how you need to be disciplined and practice. I think it's fun. And it also connects me to my dad, because my dad used to teach me magic when I was a little kid. And then when I was in college and studying abroad in Europe, I paid my trips through Europe by doing magic shows in the streets of Paris and in Bulgaria, and just had a lot of adventures doing magic.
What's one of your favorites?
One of my favorite magic?
Yeah.
Changing the time on your watch. I love card tricks also.
Speaking of cards, you have a kind card in your wallet. What is the meaning of this kind card?
So this is our latest in our effort to try to find ways to creatively inspire kindness. The challenge in doing that is that kindness, by its very essence, the reason it works is that it's a pure act where there's no ulterior purposes. So how do you inspire kindness without destroying its authenticity? So we've been toying with it for 10 years, and our latest is these cards called Kind Awesome Cards, where if we spot somebody that has done a kind act already, either to you or to a stranger, then you celebrate them and say, you know, that was really kind of you, and in appreciation for your kindness, we'd like to give you this card. And you go to the website, enter this code, and we send you a couple kind bars plus another Kind Awesome Card that you can then give to somebody else to celebrate when you spot an act of kindness that they do.
What's one act of kindness you spotted on the street the other day which caused you to take out this card and give it to a stranger?
Somebody ceded their taxi to my wife and I. It was very, very nice. And I went into my wallet and they're like, oh, no, that's not necessary. They thought I was going to give them money. And I'm like, no, this is what it is. And then they were really happy. Or somebody cedes their seat in the subway to somebody else. Or just, you know, on the sixth line on the subway lately, I don't know, people can get really mean to each other. And it's become like this laboratory of like social behavior. I don't know if you ever saw the Batman movie with the Joker where he's like creating these social experiments in Metropolis and people are like, are they going to do the right thing or the wrong thing? In the sixth train, a lot of times people are not doing the right thing. They're being really jerkish to each other. The trains are really delayed and it's kind of scary. So when somebody behaves really kindly in those environments, I give them one of those cards.
On the sixth train, the Lexington Avenue line in New York City, you mentioned your wife briefly. She's a doctor. What kind of doctor is she?
She's a transplant nephrologist.
Ah, kidney.
Yeah, you know it. When I first met her and she said a nephrologist, I'm like, oh, is that people that deal with the dead bodies? Like, no, that's a necrologist. I'm not a nephrologist. It's kidney doctor. I'm like, okay, good to know.
And a mother of four.
And a mother of four and an incredible partner, the sweetest woman in the world. And she goes to the Bronx to help for her job as a transplant nephrologist. And she's on call this week.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Jessica, thank you so much for having those really interesting questions.
My guest has been Daniel Lubetzky. Coming up, we'll meet Jonathan Cedar, co-founder of BioLite. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Jonathan Cedar, co-founder of BioLite, a company that produces clean, portable stoves for cooking off the grid in developing countries as well as for camping. The stove reduces toxic smoke emissions by 90% by using its own heat waste to generate energy. BioLite is targeting a global public health challenge of smoke pollution caused by cooking over an open fire. According to the World Health Organization, more than 7 million people die annually from smoke originating from open cooking fires. A USB port on the stove can also charge a cell phone or other portable device, which is useful to the more than 1 billion people who own cell phones but lack electricity. Jonathan graduated from Dartmouth College. Welcome.
Thank you.
How does the BioLite stove work?
Sure. So the BioLite stove is a wood-burning stove that recaptures the waste heat and turns that heat into electricity using a technology called thermoelectrics. Thermoelectrics are kind of like solar panels for heat instead of light. And we take that electricity and use it, essentially cause the smoke to reburn.
So how much smoke is the stove actually generating? If I'm looking at a stove and it's burning, am I seeing smoke?
If you see a car driving down the street and there's smoke coming out of the tailpipe, you would say to yourself, that's a badly tuned car. And if you look at an open fire or any sort of wood fire and there's smoke coming out of it, it's the same exact thing. It's a badly tuned fire. What we're able to do with our technology is take that 10% of really nasty stuff and turn it to 1% of really nasty stuff.
You mentioned wood is used to fuel or to start these fires of these stoves. What else can you put in these stoves?
Obviously wood, but also agricultural residues. So, crop waste, corn stalks, that kind of thing. Cow dung as well, dried cow dung.
Prior to starting BioLite, you worked at a firm or a company called Smart Design, which helped companies like OXO, which sells kitchen appliances, or Staples, to create innovative products. And it was there that you came up with the idea for a camping stove with your co-founder, Alex Drummond. You worked on this for more than 3 years before you even incorporated as sort of a side project. Did you have sort of an aha moment where you finally got this technology right, or was it more of a gradual process?
No, there was definitely an aha moment. So the project started nights and weekends, and it was really Alex's initial idea. His brother had given him a small wood-burning can with a battery-powered fan on the bottom of it. Alec and I are both pretty avid outdoor folk and campers, and this seemed like a great alternative to bringing those nasty petrol cans out on the trail. And there was this one aha moment in Alec's industrial loft in Dumbo, Brooklyn, where we had built this funny little bent sheet metal thing. I remember us sitting in his loft, and it's smoking, and it's not lighting, and it's not generating electricity, and, you know, we're really scratching our heads, and Alex's poor wife and daughter are, you know, choking in the other room on all the smoke we're making. And I can't remember which one of us, but one of us realizes that the wires were disconnected, and we touch the wires, and all of a sudden this smoky mess turns into this purple mushroom of clean fire, and, you know, we did this sort of inventor's high-five dance, and from there, I think we knew we were onto something.
This idea started off as a stove for camping, given your enthusiasm for the outdoors. At what point did you realize, you know, this market could be a lot larger if we address the need in developing countries?
Yeah, so after about 3 years of nights and weekends tinkering, we had what we called a looks-like-works-like prototype, right? So something that really demonstrated the potential in what we were working on. And we took it to an advanced wood combustion conference, if you believe that that exists, in Seattle, and two very unexpected things happened there. One,
this is the Ethos Conference?
This is the Ethos Conference. One, Alec and I were introduced to the fact that half the planet is still cooking on smoky open fires, and that those fires kill more people than HIV and TB and malaria combined. And two, we entered our funny little prototype into their clean stove contest, which they have every year. And we won the cleanest stove of the year, and we were the only stove that wasn't plugged into an electric wall outlet to achieve those levels of emissions. And so it was this incredible confluence of, wow, this really is an important problem, combined with, we have a very unusual and promising solution that this industry had not seen before.
You mentioned it was at the conference that you learned the global scope of this problem. And here you are, a kid from Manhattan and Scarsdale, so you didn't necessarily have much exposure to the developing world prior to this. Is that right?
No. I mean, prior to this, I had been to India once as a tourist. I had seen people cooking on open fires, but quite frankly, I had never imagined that such a prevalent practice was at the root of so much suffering.
I remember my husband and I, we were in Jordan in the Middle East in the Wadi Rum Desert, and we were sleeping in a very large tent one night with these Jordanian Bedouins. And they cooked dinner using an open flame, but that fire was actually inside the tent. Mm-hmm. And my husband, whenever we think about that trip, he's always like, yes, do you remember that night where I couldn't sleep from the smoke pollution? Is it just an education issue that people don't realize that the smoke is so bad for them? Why build the fire inside the tent, for example, versus outside the tent? You've seen that too?
Absolutely. I mean, this is how half the planet is cooking. Specifically, why inside the home? Convenience. Right? Protection, safety, comfort. It's very hard to tell people how to live their lives differently. I think the best thing that we can offer is ways to participate in existing practices and make them safer and more convenient.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Jonathan Cedar, co-founder of BioLite, a company that produces clean, biomass-powered stoves that allow clean cooking and electricity access in more than 70 countries internationally. So going back to the early days, once you decided to focus on both camping stoves and stoves in the developing world, how did you go about convincing retailers to adopt these stoves? Were there one or two that were key in this acceptance?
So in 2009, I left Smart Design to go refine the business models and raise venture capital. And I moved out to Berkeley partly to work with development economists and people focused on this issue of indoor air pollution. It turned out to be a very serendipitous time to be in that sector. In early 2010, Hillary Clinton launched the Global Alliance for Clean Cookstoves and used our technology as an example of innovation in the sector. So there was really this burgeoning interest. The U.S. State Department became interested in clean cooking and started to put some funding towards it. And so it was a very fertile time to be starting this business.
Accidentally. The timing worked out well.
Completely accidentally. I also spent about half of that year living in India as part of a social enterprise incubator called Dasra, where I was the only American company. It was me and 24 other Indian social enterprises, and it was a wonderful education. I understand campers. I shop at REI. I go camping on weekends. I don't understand what it's like to, or at least certainly at the time I didn't, understand what it was like to cook in a village, to buy things in a village, to deliver things to a village. So those two experiences combined really helped me refine what the business model was to a point where we could take this thing that sounded kind of crazy initially and actually put some venture capital behind it.
One of your early investors is Clayton Christensen, who is the author of Innovator's Dilemma. He's a professor at Harvard Business School. In a way, you are living that Innovator's Dilemma because you have these large incumbents who could produce these stoves, but just the infrastructure and the inertia and the entrenchment of these companies just causes them not to focus on this, whereas you don't have that burden.
I think that's right. I do think when we've seen larger companies like BP, like Philips come to the market, they bring all of the baggage and history from where they're coming from. And so if you look at BP, for example, when they tried to solve the cook stove problem in India, they said, great, we'll be a fuel company, right? So we'll sell these stoves at subsidized rates at a loss, and then we will, through selling biomass pellets, pay the stoves off over time. Well, turns out BP is very good at selling gasoline. BP is not very good at sourcing agricultural waste from 1,000 smallholder farms, turning those into pellets and moving those out through a rural distribution channel. And that's nothing wrong with BP. That's an incredibly hard thing to do. But we weren't burdened with those kinds of presumptions coming into our market.
What were some barriers in the cultural arena that you didn't foresee?
Sure. Oftentimes, one of the biggest barriers to women adopting clean cookstoves is that it's not valuable to their husbands. You know, men are typically controlling the finances of these households. This is an expensive product. Like, there's no two ways around that.
So is it roughly $40 a stove?
Yeah, that's about right.
And these are people who are making $2 a day or
it
varies?
It's a very wide spectrum, but I would say from $2 to $10 a day. But what we have very interestingly found is that the fact that our stoves generate electricity engages men in the cook stove question in ways that men never have before. And it's very funny. If you look at our village demonstrations, there are typically more men in the circle than women, and that is unusual for a cook stove.
Because of that USB connection to their cell phones.
That's right.
What about the smoke? I mean, we instinctively say, oh, yeah, smoke is a bad thing. But what is the reaction of these people who don't see much smoke coming out of the stoves?
Well, my favorite quote that I've heard a number of times in the villages is, well, where did you put the smoke? The conversation isn't so much this is going to change your health over a 20-year time horizon. That's not really what's compelling. What's compelling is I can save you time. I can save how much fuel you're using. I can keep your eyes from watering while you're cooking. I can keep your house cleaner, right? A sooty wall is the sign of a less developed household, that we can really provide these aspirational qualities, which are the same reasons you and I purchase 90% of the things that we buy.
Fashion.
Right. Fashion. Well, yet, fashion and function and convenience.
What is some pushback that you've witnessed? For instance, in Myanmar, some people said that the stove was, it was too small. It seemed like a toy.
Well, so this was interesting. That was a test that we ran in 2009. We said, great, we can use this camp stove to solve a huge world problem. And so the first thing we heard was, well, I'm not going to break my twigs up into a million little pieces, and this doesn't cook for a family of eight. And I think that's when we started to understand, okay, it might be one technology, but it's not one product.
Because the stove was too small for a family of eight.
It was too small, and it didn't cook with the wood that they cooked on.
And how about between countries? So while you ultimately might have gotten a cultural acceptance in Myanmar with a bigger stove, why might it not work in India?
So there were certain things that needed to be different, right? So in India, it needed to cook chapati well, which is a thin flatbread that gets cooked on this kind of conical dish called a tava. And we found for a while that our flames were too concentrated in the center, and so they would burn the chapati, and we needed to find ways to diffuse the flame better. In Ghana, the staple food is called banku, and it's this very glutinous, starchy thing that you stir with a huge, heavy stick, and they actually use bent rebar that they stand on to hold the pots from tipping over while they cook. And so we needed to make sure that our stoves could work with that. But what we've actually found is that by and large, our stoves work fairly well for most of what you would have normally done over an open fire. People warned us that, you know, you need a different stove for every community, and that's not what we found. And, you know, I think it's unsurprising that it's not what we found, because if you look at what most people in these communities aspire to use, it's LPG, liquefied petroleum gas, so, you know, gas. And gas burners look about the same everywhere you go, and anyone who has enough money and lives in a place where that's accessible uses that.
I want to go from Ghana to Washington Square Park in New York City. There was an introduction to the public of your stoves after Hurricane Sandy. How helpful was that with the PR and raising awareness of what you were doing? And,
sure.
And what did you do?
I was actually stuck. I was stuck in Seattle. I was planning our launch with REI, and a couple of our engineers took it upon themselves to take a bunch of inventory out of the office and set up tables in Washington Square Park and then in front of City Hall and then out in the Rockaways and make people tea and charge their cell phones. And it was really interesting. Even in a city with as modern an infrastructure as New York, we realize how vulnerable we are and how dependent. And the biggest pain point that people found was that they couldn't charge their cell phones and tell their loved ones that everything was okay. With a device as small as ours, you were able to cross that kind of minimum energy threshold.
You mentioned REI. It's an outdoor camping store. How important was REI in all of this?
REI has been a phenomenal partner for us. So they came to us at about the same time we launched online in 2012 and said, we want to launch you guys at retail. And we spent close to a year planning what became the biggest stove launch they've ever had.
I want to talk about your personal life for a minute. You live in Brooklyn.
I do.
In fact, you ski to work sometimes.
I did cross-country ski to work one day this winter. It was definitely the best day of my winter. If it was up to me, it would be winter all the time. It's a little bit weird running an outdoor company here in New York City, but I've always been passionate about the outdoors. I went to college in New Hampshire and worked as an outdoor educator for a couple of years after college.
On a ship, you spent a year as an engineer and a teacher where you taught navigation skills, basically, operation skills on a 135-foot ship.
Yeah. So after college, I was recruited to be the engineer for an oceanographic research program that ran 150-foot ships across oceans, running the engineering facilities of the ship. So the you know, propulsion engines, the refrigeration, the electrical generation, the water makers.
Now, did you have an interest in the sea? Here you were, you know, a kid from the suburbs, or was it kind of incidental that it happened to be the sea? It could have been trains.
No, I really loved sailing little tiny dinghies as a kid on a lake near where my grandparents spent a lot of time.
What do your parents do?
My mom is a pediatrician and my dad is a corporate lawyer.
Were you always tinkering as a kid?
Yeah, I drove my parents nuts. I broke everything in our house trying to fix it. But growing up, my uncle would give me tools for every birthday, so, you know, socket drivers and all this stuff. And I'd go out to his house and he'd allow me to strap the leaf blower to the skateboard and buzz up and down the street. So, yeah, I was always very mechanically curious.
David Kelly is kind of a grandfather in the product design innovation world. He started a company called IDEO and the Stanford D School. In what way was he influential for you?
I was bobbing around the Sargasso Sea and randomly pulled his book, The Art of Innovation, off of the small library that we had and started reading it. And
on this 150-foot ship?
On this 150-foot ship.
Okay.
It's a closet with some books in it.
Mm-hmm.
Started reading the book, and I think I was about 25 pages in when I started writing my application to become an intern at Smart Design.
You also play the banjo. Did you bring your banjo as you travel the world?
I did. I had my banjo at sea with me, and I have a mini banjo that I oftentimes take with me when I travel in India or Africa, and it makes for nice conversation.
Do you play the banjo while you're pedaling your stoves?
No, but that might be next year's marketing plan.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
My guest has been Jonathan Cedar, co-founder of BioLite.
If you would like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.
Jack, you're free, you're a cop, railroad train.